Welcome to Hidden History of Rock and Roll with your host, Tiffany Scott. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Hidden History of Rock and Roll.
Hello, and welcome to Hidden History of Rock and Roll. I'm your host, Tiffany Scott, and if you are new to my podcast, I do a deep dive into the behind-the-scenes stories of rock's greatest legends, how they came to be, how the records got played, and maybe some dirty little secrets, if we're lucky. This is your all-access backstage pass. Today, I have another industry legend on the show. He has been in the music industry for well over 50 years. He was working at places like RCA, Island Records, Charisma, Elektra, Geffen, Giant Records, and Curb Records with some amazing, iconic bands. Allow me to introduce the bands before I go ahead and introduce you.
Sure.
Jefferson Starship, Rick Springfield, Triumph, I hope I have enough air for all this, Hall & Oates, Dolly Parton, Elvis, U2, Melissa Etheridge, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Anthrax, Tom Waits, Robert Palmer, Tone Loken, Young MC, Maxi Priest, Right Said Fred, Gary Moore, Brent
Bourgeois,
thank you, The Knack, Jellyfish, Metallica, 10,000 Maniacs, Fish, Silk, Nirvana, Aerosmith, whoa, Guns N' Roses, Beck, Garbage, Lisa Loeb, Counting Crows, The Eagles, George Michael, one of my favorites is Disturbed. We're going to see that tour. Steely Dan and Owsley Stanley, did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
Curb, Tim McGraw, Leanne Rimes, Mercy Me, and Mercy Me for this resume, Winona Judd, and last but not least, a couple of indie projects that were famous, Michael Franti and Sixpence None the Richer. Welcome to the show, Bob Catania.
Thanks, Tiffany.
Yeah.
I really feel old.
please.
And then I look at that list and it's just mind-blowing. And that's just kind of the surface. There was so many other artists that were fantastic artists that didn't have the level of success that a lot of these did. And but I remember something about every one of these projects. It's really amazing to be a guest here and be able to talk about the couple of things we're going to talk about, but to look at the breadth of everything that I've worked on over the years is pretty staggering.
Yeah, it seems to be the consensus among everybody that I've talked to is like, wow, I can't believe I worked with all these amazing artists. But when it comes down to writing a book or writing these stories down, it's very tedious and very difficult. And sometimes it's great to just have a talking book. And this podcast is what that's all about.
I know some of your previous guest, like the legendary John Scott, who I've known forever.
Ooh.
It's really great. Yeah. It's really great to talk to us veteran promotion guys because there's so many stories and I don't have any dirty little secrets. I was a pretty mundane kind of guy in the business. Everyone who did what I did worked really hard on behalf of these artists. And it's great that you talk about the hidden history because the promotion guys were the people behind the scenes. There were some promotion guys that had bigger than life personalities who were as well known as some of the artists, or if not more so. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of us, we were just happy to be behind the scenes. These people are the stars. And it was really an honor and privilege to be able to help get their music exposed, you know, however way, you know, we did it. So, and I know we're going to talk about a couple specifics, but I'm looking at this going, wow, there's, I could do 100 of these with you and
talk about
all of that. So
yeah, you have a large body of work. And a lot of people ask me when I post questions on Facebook or Instagram, who is your guest? And I said, You don't know them. That's the premise of the hidden history of rock and roll. These are the people that are behind the scenes that you don't know and have some incredible stories to share. And I call them the friends and family stories because we all talk about them, all the, you know, industry, in the insiders. We all just laugh and have these great conversations, but all the people, they don't know these right. stories. And I think it's a great way to bring them.
Right. One of my most enjoyable things is for about 15 years, I've been doing spin classes. I go 3 times a week. And one of my teachers there, her name is Linda, who's a great spin teacher and a great music person. And over the years, she'd be playing music and I'd go, you know, I promoted that song.
Wow.
Like, what? And I go, I promoted that song. And after I had to explain to her, and then sometimes people in the class would go, are you a musician, a producer? I go, yeah. No, I just promoted that. And they don't really know what that means.
Exactly.
But it's really funny. I'll hear a song that I promoted in a spin class thinking, boy, 15, 20, 30 years ago, I never thought I'd be hearing that song
in a spin class.
In this context, you know. It's so funny. So it's great to have, you know, yeah. a lot of people hear a song and go, wow, that's a great memory.
Yeah.
For me, a lot of those songs, it's a great memory and a memory of what went into making that song a hit.
So. Yeah, that's and fantastic. And we want to get to know you, not only the artist and what happened behind the scenes, but I want to know a little bit about how you got started in the music industry and what your first job was.
Yeah, I got really lucky. When I went to college, I went to Glassboro State College in Southern New Jersey, and I went there thinking, I want to be a teacher. Seemed like a good thing to do. My first day in the dorm, I'm in my room, and this guy from across the hall walks in and goes, hey, welcome to the dorm. And for some bizarre reason, I just said to him, is there a college radio station here? And he goes, I'm the news director. Are you interested in being on the air?
Whoa.
And like a half hour later, I'm in the radio station reading news. And I ended up on the college radio station. All thoughts of being a teacher completely went away. And
what,
I ended
what
up-
What year was that?
I started college in 72.
Okay.
So, and I ended up being on, you know, doing news. And then I became the music director. And then the station manager, and I had an air shift. So I had this love of music, and I thought, okay, I'm not going to be a teacher. I'm going to be a disc jockey. Mm. One of my roommate's high school friend worked at a record distributor in Philadelphia. It was it was in the worst part of Philadelphia. It was a dangerous, dangerous neighborhood where you would normally have a warehouse, you okay. know. A huge warehouse, and it was Universal Record Distributors, nothing to do with Universal Music Group. And they distributed hundreds of small labels, and a lot of them weren't so small. They were A&M Records and United Artists. Mm-hmm. And one night at a campus party, my friend's high school friend who worked there said, I'm so behind in all the mailings. I can't keep up with everything. I said, well, I have a pretty light class schedule. I was kind of ahead. I was still working at the station. And I got a part-time job working in the mailroom.
Oh, wow.
Which became a full-time job. It was probably making $100 a week, but I was inside of a record distributor, mm-hmm. and I was getting free albums, and I was answering the phones, and I was mailing records and all of that. And I figured out in my young brain that this is a great networking opportunity and a great learning environment being in the mailroom. So I got to know everybody in the building, especially all the promotion people, and ended up being a gopher for a lot of them. And I would answer the phones, and I'd talk to radio stations, and it was more of like, hey, we need, you know, our 45 is scratched. Can you get us another copy of that 45? Or in Philadelphia itself, I get a call from WMMR. Hey, one of our albums is scratched. Can you run one over? So I would do that. I ended up meeting a lot of people there. And one day I found out that there was, it was probably about 7 or 8 months in, that RCA Records was looking for a local promotion person. And I was talking to one of the radio people that used to come and visit. And he said, hey, kid, how are things going? I go, good. He goes, what's going on? I said, well, I hear there's this RCA job open, but I can't get an interview. He goes, you want that job? I said, well, I'd like to have an interview. And he put me on hold. And 5 minutes later, he said, you have an interview next Wednesday, you know, dress nicely and go to the interview. And I ended up being a local person in Philadelphia for RCA Records. And that was 1977. I joined, like, I think it was just a few weeks after Elvis Presley had died.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite
a week,
quite a time at RCA Records then.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I took the college radio experience, which led me to the distribution experience, working in the mailroom, into the local job, and then never looked back.
And then just to skip ahead, you had shared a really great story with me about how you feel about the music industry. And someone had talked to you at that time when you were in the mailroom and given his opinion.
Oh, the Matty Singer story. So there was a legendary promotion guy there named Matty, the Humdinger Singer. all the promotion guys back in the generation or two before me all had nicknames. There was Matty, the Humdinger Singer. There was Billy, the Hitmaker Harper. And they all had little round stickers that they would put on the 45s that they would send to the radio station. So it would say courtesy of Billy Hitmaker Harper. But I remember getting started, and Matty, who was a total character, came up to me one day and said, kid, it's such a shame you missed the golden age of the music business. It's over. You missed it. And I remember I went home to my woman I was married to at the time, and I said, I can't believe it. You know, I finally got in and I missed it, only to then have a 50-year career, you know, going through, you know, one would argue the greatest time in the music industry. And I always tell people who ask me about the music business today, and they go, well, it's not the same music business. I go, well, it's not. And it doesn't mean it's better or worse than what it used to be, because for the kid who's starting like I did now, their career is going to be the greatest time in the music industry for them. You know, it's just going to be different. So, and I know you've talked to other people. It's the promotion that your dad did and I did and Steve Meyer and all those people. That's gone now, but it's something different.
Different.
Which is not bad. It's just different.
I think it's really a unique way to look at it.
Yeah.
For sure.
I just want to start with going to work for Island Records was unbelievable for me. As a teenager, I was collecting albums. I loved music in high school, college, you know, college radio station. But for me, Island Records was always like maybe the first label I became aware of as a label, and understanding that anything on that label is going to be of the greatest quality and probably my musical taste. And eventually there was labels like A&M and Chrysalis Records, that kind of Warner Brothers, they had that same feeling. But I grew up collecting Island Records. I had the little book of Island Records and understood that a lot of the artists that were signed to Island Records in the UK ended up on US different labels through distribution deals. So you would go, well, Mott the Hoople's on Atlantic Records, but they were really signed by Chris Blackwell at Island Records. And Cat Stevens was on A&M Records in the US, but he was an Island Records signing. So when I joined Island in 1984, Chris Blackwell, who owned the label, had decided even though he had a distribution deal with Warners, he wanted to have more control over his artists and was going to bring in a staff of his own promotion people to make sure that those records didn't get lost in the shuffle. So I came over there in 1984. I had worked with Phil Cordero, the late, great Phil Cordero, at RCA Records, and he went to Island. And I called him up one day and I said, please take me, get me out of here. You know, there had been some things at RCA that didn't go my way and it was time to move on. And Phil was gracious enough to bring me into Island as the head of rock promotion. So I'm in this most amazing place and I get to talk to Chris Blackwell, which sometimes was a great thing and sometimes was a difficult thing. As any genius of that level is going to be. And it wasn't the first project that I started on there, but it was the first big one was U2. And I'll start this off by saying, when people ask me about my career and they go, what's the hardest project you ever worked? I go, that's easy. It's U2. And then everyone goes, don't be ridiculous. They're U2. I go, well, they're U2 now. When I got there, they weren't U2. And maybe we can kind of blend in that question at somebody talked about U2 being a college band and was that intentional or whatever. So I wasn't around for the first few U2 albums. Those were all through Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers promotion promoted them. So that was Boy, War, October, Under a Blood Red Sky. So that I had nothing to do with those. And I know that the college radio was huge because college radio was very coordinated back then. And you had college radio charts and they gravitated towards U2, which made a lot of sense. And I think the early success of U2 was really at the what you would call either the modern rock or alternative stations. But in the early days, you know, K-Rock in L.A., WLIR on Long Island, you know, kind of they weren't the mainstream rock stations at the time, but they were the people that were looking for new artists and new music. So I knew there was a foundation there. And so when the Unforgettable Fire, which was the first album I worked, came in, We all gave it a listen, and it was really very different from some of the early U2 albums. It was much more melodic. It was a little bit more ethereal. It wasn't this hard edge driving alternative college rock thing. So I was like, okay, this is not what I thought it was going to be, but it was brilliant. It was just an amazing record. And I was very excited to start talking to rock radio about U2, and found out very quickly that there wasn't much of an appetite for U2. And I think a lot of it was, remember the conversations would always be something to the effect of Minneapolis or Des Moines or Savannah or something. It's like, what relevance does that band, some punk band from Dublin, what does that mean to our audience? And there's something valid about that. And again, their radio exposure was really kind of limited to that college and modern rock era. So we figured out pretty quickly we had our work cut out for us. This wasn't going to be like mailing the record in and all of a sudden, you know, we were going to have a massive success. The thing with that album that really stood out was obviously Pride in the Name of Love. And that was the song that had a lot of energy. Other songs on the album, again, had a more sophisticated feel to them. But this was a pop song. So we focused in on that as the lead single and started to break down some barriers. I want to look at my... there was some concern at radio that it had a kind of a political bent to it. You know, it was about Martin Luther King and being assassinated. So it wasn't exactly a U2 love song, you know.
Right.
And like a lot of their music, it had a message to it. And sometimes that doesn't always go over well. But the song seemed to resonate. We had that bass, college stations, you know, again, the LIRs, the K-Rocks. And then the coasts kind of, you know, kind of came in on it, you know, the Northeast, you know, the LA, San Francisco. I should mention XRT in Chicago was always early on. So we suddenly had a foundation of some really good rock stations playing the song, and it was resonating. You know, it was, you know, blowing up the phones, it was selling. And the other thing with U2 is that management, Paul McGinnis and his team, they had done a great job of having the band on the road, building a foundation. It's like the old days of the business. You know, they played small clubs, they played medium clubs, then it was 3,000 seaters. And so as this record was developing, they were continuing to play. So a lot of times, you know, the conversation could be with a radio station and they would go, yeah, nobody cares about U2. Well, they just sold 15,000 tickets in your market, you know, in a half hour,
wow.
You know, that kind of thing. I remember they played New York City. I think it was two nights at the Garden, two nights at the Meadowlands, and one night out on Long Island. And there was like 100,000 tickets available. And Scott Shannon, who was programming Z100 at the time, I think it was Z, called up Phil Q and goes, hey, who's this band that you have that just sold 100,000 tickets in my backyard in an afternoon? Well, you know, that kind of a thing.
Right.
So those are, right. You know, some of the stories that helped us, you know, develop this. I'm just looking at my notes here. Sorry.
Scott Shannon is great. And he had just got back to me. He's going to do an episode.
Right. Okay.
And I'm super excited about it, but
just one of the all time greats. So we ended up, looking at my notes, we got that song to number 2
oh, good.
On the rock charts.
Oh, great.
Which was really,